Would you please first just introduce yourself?
You bet. My name is Lance Seafeld. I'm a professor in the chemistry and biochemistry department here at USU.
Wonderful. And I want to hear it from you. Why did I ask you here today?
Right. Well, so we just had a paper accepted in the most prestigious journal in all of science called Science. And the paper describes a pretty revolutionary breakthrough that we've made in the area of nitrogen fixation. So a little background about that. You know that the air that we're breathing is about 80% N2. And the N2 gas is inert to you and to me and to nearly all life. But yet all of life needs nitrogen of some form. So we're in this sort of interesting world where we're swimming in nitrogen, but we can't get our hands on it. So how do we get our hands on that nitrogen? We need it for our proteins. We need it for our DNA. So how do we get our hands on it? Well, there's two processes that are used in the world right now to get nitrogen at scale. And both of them grab the N2 out of the air that we're breathing and turn it into a form that life can use called ammonia. One of those processes is called the Haber-Bosch process. This was invented in Germany in about 1908, and it's revolutionized world population. Before the invention of Haber-Bosch, the world population was stagnant, mostly because of a limitation of protein. And Haber-Bosch, this chemistry, is able to take N2 gas out of the air and turn it into ammonia, which then we use as fertilizer on our crops. And then that fertilizer, that nitrogen that's in the fertilizer, turns into our food, whether we feed it to ourselves or to our animals. And so that's really revolutionized all of life. It comes with a cost, and the cost is that was driven by fossil fuel. It's a very energy-demanding process. About 2 or 3% of all the fossil fuel that we use in the world today goes into this one process, which means that its carbon dioxide or CO2 footprint is really large, its greenhouse gas footprint. So that's been fine as long as fossils have been cheap and as long as we're not too worried about CO2, but now those things are starting to become an issue. So we have been working on another process, the biological process. This is how the other way that we get N2 fixed or converted into a form ammonia that we can use. This happens in bacteria that live in our soil. And these bacteria don't have to have these high temperatures and high pressures that Haber-Bosch have. So we've been trying to understand the energetics of that process. And what we know is that the biological process requires also a lot of energy. It's demanding on the cell, the bacterial cell. So here we have two processes that are different in many ways, but they both have the commonality that they require enormous amounts of energy to do this reaction. So this discovery that we've made, we partnered up with a group at the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado. Their expertise is in using sunlight. So what we did was we paired up one of their technologies, which is something called a nanorod. It's a nanomaterial. This nanomaterial can absorb light, sunlight, and then use that energy to drive electrons. And those electrons are what we needed for our system, so-called nitrogenase. So we married those two together, and what we achieved was the ability to eliminate all of the fossil energy need or the energy need that would be on a cell, and to get all of the energy from sunlight to do this chemistry of reducing into ammonia.
And if I understand correctly, I mean, you did this, it's using ATP, right? This adenosine triphosphate. I'm not going to explain that on the radio. But,
right.
But I mean, as a biologist, like that's what powers, right. I mean, us at
everything.
Like the simplest level, right? I mean, so
right.
A lot of what I'd like to, that was perfect, by the way.
Okay,
and
great.
I'll try and break it down a little bit
sure.
now because I have some specific questions.
Right.
And one of the things I want to do is, I'm hoping that you have some good analogies, not
okay.
only for like the difference between like, you know, N2 and,
right.
and like, how do you explain that? But then
sure.
also, I think it's just incredible that you guys are essentially using the same molecule. Is it a protein? What is ATP?
Yeah, ATP is a molecule.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's the power center for, I mean,
right.
all living things,
all
right?
living things, that's
and
right.
You really are just kind of taking it outside of, doing
yeah.
the same chemical reaction that's going on in the bacteria and just
right.
taking it outside of the bacteria, correct?
Well,
it,
yeah, we've already done that. We've already been able to take the enzyme out of the bacteria and do the chemistry in, we call in vitro, in glass, outside of the bacteria. The real breakthrough here was that rather than using ATP, we're using sunlight as the sole source of energy.
Oh.
And so this, as you mentioned, ATP is the energy currency in living cells. This process is hugely energy demanding. It requires 16 ATPs for every one N2 that's reduced. That drains the cell of all of its energy. So what we've done is we've taken that system apart married it to this nanomaterial, and now we don't need any ATP. So we can do this. That was the revolution. That's why the paper was accepted at Science, is we're using 100% of the energy from sunlight.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, and it's this nanomaterial that takes the place of the ATP.
Exactly.
Because the sunlight has to go, I mean,
right.
It doesn't, you don't just cook it in the sun. Like, there's got to be something. Okay.
And that's what the nanomaterial does, is it's absorbing the energy from light and then converting that energy into a way that we can drive this reaction happening in a way that ATP normally does. So that's really the revolution of this, is that rather than using fossil like you use in Haber-Bosch, and rather than using ATP like we use in the biological system, we're using a totally different form of energy. We're using sunlight directly.
I see. So in a way, we're talking about solar-powered fertilizer production.
That's right, exactly. Cool. And, you know, where you want to go with this ultimately is you'd like to get away from the use of fossil, obviously, as a way to drive our food supply. But if you think about the developing world doesn't have access to big Haber-Bosch plants. They don't have access to all the energy that you need to do that. So in the developing world, the availability of nitrogen for the fertilizer is commonly the limiting material that you need for food production. So ultimately, where you'd like to go with this kind of technology is you'd like to develop, I call it widgets, basically devices that you could deploy in small villages, et cetera, where you could actually make a small device that would use sunlight and then the air we're breathing and turn it into fertilizer that you could then apply to the crops directly. They wouldn't have the need to transport all this ammonia. They wouldn't have the need for Haber-Bosch reaction. They wouldn't have the need for all the fossil energy that goes into that.
And so that leads in really nicely to a question of kind of scalability or
right.
applicability that I wanted right. to talk to you about. So, I mean, when you do this in the lab now, what
right.
you published, how
right.
big is this machine, or I mean, how big is your petri dish?
Yeah, right. That's a good question. So, you know, there's different kinds of science, and what we do is called fundamental science. We're trying to understand because, you know, we realize that until you understand something, you can never use it. When you translate fundamental science into what's called applied science, that's a whole different world. That's where the engineers come in. That's not what we do. So when you ask about the scale of what we're doing this on a scale that you can't see. These are individual molecules that we're doing. Now, the products that we make enough of them that we can detect them with our instruments, et cetera. So really the breakthrough for us is understanding. It's a fundamental thing. So in terms of building a device, you know, that's not going to be something that we would do. We're trying to understand the intricacies, the details of this so that you could build a device.
And so, and thank you for correcting me. That's an important distinction to
right.
make.
Right.
And certainly the onus is not on you to do. I
right.
think you've done the bigger
right.
task.
Right.
But I mean, from what you, I know you're not an engineer.
Right.
I mean, but like based on what it takes for this process, which
sure.
my understanding at this point is that it's sunlight and
yep.
some nano. Thing.
Right. Yeah.
Is it unreasonable to think that this could be, you could have a machine the size of a something that you could put on wheels? I mean,
that's
the size
right.
of a truck? Okay, so.
Yeah, no, that's reasonable. And I think really the breakthrough, like in any breakthrough, the breakthrough is in what we call proof of concept. Can you do it? And if you can actually do it, then that shows you just have to find the pathway to make it feasible at a good price, you know, that you could do something that's robust that doesn't fall apart all the time. So I think really we view this as really the big breakthrough because it shows that you can do this.
Wonderful. And could you talk, I mean, you touched on it, but I would really like to stress, I mean, I don't have time to talk about the Haber-Bosch,
right.
is it Haber-Bosch
right,
Haber-Bosch
right.
process and what goes into that and why it's so important. I mean,
sure.
that's a whole podcast episode unto itself.
It is.
But I think it's really important. I mean, this goes beyond just the cleanness of it, which is
right.
very important. I mean,
yes.
I'm an ecologist. I get
right.
that. But
you
like,
get it. Yeah.
we have a growing population. And when
yes.
the Haber-Bosch came out, there was concerns that how would we ever feed the
exactly.
growing population? And from my understanding, we basically can feed the world now because
yeah.
of it. But now we're almost coming up to the limitations
sure.
of what that is. Now there's issues with just, I mean, you only have so much land with which
right.
to grow crops, right?
Right.
But now we have... Do you feel comfortable talking a little bit about the agriculture or the food impact of this study?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, you bring up the good point about Haber-Bosch. It really revolutionized food production over the last 100 years. And there's some estimates that about 40% of the world population wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for Haber-Bosch. It's such an important process. It's in the top 5 industrial processes in the world. But as you mentioned, the challenge there is that it's so dependent on fossil fuel because of the high temperatures and the high pressures that it utilizes. It's a very efficient process. It's been perfected over 100 years, but it's very energy demanding. And as long as we have cheap fossil and we don't care about the CO2, it's fine. But that's now changing. That's a landscape that's changing. So a lot of folks, including the Department of Energy, U.S. Department of Agriculture, are really interested in new ways, so-called sustainable ways of doing this process. This is a breakthrough that really shows us a pathway to using sunlight as a way to make it sustainable.
Wonderful. Thank you. I think this will I probably can only make like a 60 to 90
sure,
second
piece. Sure, that's fine.
I might be able to convince my editor to do something longer, sure. Which I think I'd like to do because I think there's a lot there. But yep. It'll be short.
Yep.
And I think that this is wonderful. I appreciate you're very good at this.
good, thanks.
So thank you very much. But what have I not asked you? What's important that we haven't talked about yet?
Yeah, I think one of the things I'd like to emphasize is that, this was really a team effort. It has four different teams involved in this. The team here at USU that I head, the team at the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado. There's also a team at the University of Colorado Boulder, and then a team at Montana State University. No one of the teams by themselves could have pulled this off. None of us have the breadth of expertise that was required to make this happen. And so really what this shows you is you have to bring together teams, and sometimes it's outside your own area. Bring together teams to really try to accomplish a really big problem. And that's what we did. We set about this about a year ago. We started on this project. And at first, we had very limited success. We weren't achieving the kinds of things we wanted. But we just kept doing the experiments, kept talking by video conferences and things like that using new technology. And then we had the breakthrough in about early in December. And that's really a thing I'd like to emphasize, is it really takes a team of world experts working together to work on these kinds of big problems.
How many people? I mean, not just PIs, but like technicians, undergrads, I don't even know. I mean, like how many people were involved in this?
Yeah, it's a good question. So there's four groups it's mostly around the Intermountain West, which is sort of fun that we're all in the same region. But each of the groups has four or five people included. So there's upwards of 20 people that were involved in different aspects of this project, and everybody had to do their part to make it all work.
And how long from the start of like when you first started trying to do it? Well, I imagine people have been trying to do this for a long time. But right. When your project started to what you said December.
Yeah. So we started about 10 years ago, actually, trying to understand how we could do this chemistry without the need for the ATP, this cellular energy. And we had very limited success. And it was about a year ago that we were approached by the National Renewable Energy Lab. And they said, hey, let's marry our two technologies together and see if we can get this to work. And so it was about a year ago, working basically 20 people working on this pretty much, full time until we finally got the breakthrough.
Excellent. I think that's everything. Though this won't go on air, but
sure.
What is there? I mean, is there any sounds associated with these processes? I'm sure if you go to a Haber-Bosch plant, it's just some huge monstrosity, banging and clanking.
Right.
Is there anything in your lab that we could hear? Like, could I hold up a microphone and hear something?
Well, you could hear. A lot of what we do is in the absence of oxygen, because the cell actually removes the oxygen from this process. So what we do in the laboratory is we have a lot of pumps that are whirring, and so there's a lot of sounds in the laboratory. And so if you wanted to bring a little, recording device over, you could get some really cool background sounds.
I would very much like to do
that. Yeah,
yeah. Would that be possible in the next couple of days or something like
absolutely.
That?
Yeah, okay. Just come on over. I mean, tomorrow or Friday, you're welcome to come over to the lab. We're in the Widso Building, 241.
Where's the Widso Building?
It's sandwiched between the Student Center and Old Main.
Okay, sure.
It's that building there.
All right,
we're in Widso 241. And you're welcome to come over. I sort of love NPR, and so I listen to this. And I'm always amazed at the sound effects that they bring in. It makes the story so much richer.
Right. And that's and there's been a big push to do that locally here at UPR as well to try and step up our game a little bit.
Yeah, no, that's great.
And you're right. It just makes for so much better reporting.
It does. But we've got some really cool pumps. There's actually a pump over there that's an old pump, which makes a lot of cool sound because it makes sort of this gurgling sound.
Right.
So it goes like that. And I think the sound effect would just be great.
Oh, that's perfect. Yeah. I will be over there tomorrow at some point. I'll email you.
Email me and we can pick a time.
Oh, that is exactly what I was hoping that you would say. Yeah. I was worried you were going to be like, nah, it's just a machine. You just hit go and there's a small whirring and that's it. Like,
no, there's some sounds.
Awesome.
And we have some good graphics. I don't know if that's something you tend not to use graphics.
Everything goes on the web.
Yeah.
So all the way. And generally that's just more like essentially a transcript with the audio embedded so people can listen to it. But I would love to. Oh, that's right. I had another question for you. But I would love to be able to show something very simple for a lay audience that stresses this. again, I don't know if it's worth trying to delve into this, but I think it's one of the things that's wonderful about this story and wonderful about this issue is that, yeah, it's 80%. It's everywhere. I mean, it's more everywhere. Abundant than what we're actually using when we breathe.
Right, we're only using the 20%.
Right. Yeah. And so it's this phenomenally abundant thing, but for whatever reason, it's in this form that we can't get
to.
It's
so hard.
And it takes, I mean... Who knows how long it took evolutionarily for the bacteria to figure out how to do this.
Right.
And then it took us how many years of human civilization for Haber-Bosch to come along. I mean, this is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And a paradox because of how abundant it is. I mean, is there an analogy? Like when you talk to your, your brother-in-law or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, how do you explain, like, do you have a way to convey like the difference between N2 and NH3 and how you actually get there?
Yeah. I mean, I think the important thing to know about N2 is that it's two nitrogen elements that are linked together by a triple bond. So most elements, most molecules have single bonds. But think about this like a Tinker Toy set is when you have, you know, two Tinker Toy balls and they're linked together by a single stick, you can get rotations. It's pretty easy to pull them apart. But if you stick three sticks between them, that's really tough. And so that's exactly what this N2 molecule is. It's two nitrogens with a triple bond. You can put out fires with this. I mean, this molecule is really difficult to break, and it is the most difficult bond to break in all of chemistry. And so that's the challenge. That's why it takes so much energy. And in this case, we're using sunlight to do that chemistry.
Oh, this is wonderful. Yeah. I don't want to take out too much more time. I've got more audio than I know what to do with.
Yep, you do.
This has been
great.
An honor.
You
pleasure.
Bet.
Thank you.
Yeah. So if you need graphics, you know, I can give you some of that,
definitely.
and something to sort of draw your attention. I can give you that.
So when you say graphics, I mean, are we talking about like the figures that went into science, or something that's a little bit more user friendly?
So we actually worked with Marianne Mufaletto over in our place on a graphic that's really simple, and it really shows.